flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Looking for a new home should be exciting, not frustrating. That's why Homes.com might just be the best home shopping site out there. Imagine searching for your dream home without ads cluttering your view. Homes.com's sleek, beautifully designed, ad-free interface makes your search simple and distraction-free. And if you're a parent, you know how important school information is. Homes.com gets it. They're the only site with detailed school and district info from multiple sources, including reviews from Niche. Plus, they've got a super comprehensive and transparent agent directory, making it easy to find the right expert to guide your journey. Oh, and here's a game changer. Homes.com always connects you directly with a listing agent who knows the home best. They even go beyond the basics, offering the most in-depth neighborhood content of any home shopping site, packed with details to help you find a community that feels like home. And the search tools? Unmatched. With 22 data visualization layers, 7 environmental layers, and filters for commute times and architectural styles, Homes.com truly is the home search you've been searching for. Go to Homes.com. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Folks, this week is National School Choice Week, and joining us to talk to talk about this is Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Nules. Great to be back with you.
Daniel, happy New Year to you. First time that we've had a chance to talk this new year. I hope you and your family are having a great new year.
Very good. Same to you. We're doing great over here.
So, Daniel, National School Choice Week, obviously this is a time to celebrate the passage of laws across this country in a number of states that provide school choice. Where do we kind of stand nationally, and where do you, and can you talk about successes, failures, or otherwise with the way some of the implementation of this has happened over the years?
You know, absolutely. Louisiana's been in an interesting place relative to the National School Choice Week National School Choice landscape. For years, we were one of the leaders, you know, with certainly the charter and choice district here in Orleans Parish, and an early voucher program and an early tax credit scholarship program, all of which helped a lot of kids access a quality education that best met their needs. The truth is, in the last few years, we've fallen a little bit behind of Florida and Arizona, West Virginia, other states who have adopted universal education freedom in the form of education savings accounts. Of course, last year, the legislature passed the L.A. Gator program. Now they'll have to come back in this legislative session, make sure it's funded and implemented and ready for kids to take advantage of it.
Daniel, when we look across the country, let me ask the question this way. When we look here in the city of New Orleans, you know, the creation of charter schools, we became almost a 100% charter school district.
That's right.
How would you rate it on a scale from 1 to 10? I mean, many of these have been incredibly troubled. Many are closed. Many are still in the process of reconstituting, re-engineering themselves. Your assessment of the success or failure of this, of what we've had here in New Orleans. And that's not a knock on school choice. I mean,
sure.
I think it just reveals challenges, right?
No question about it. There's challenges in the education system overall. In Orleans Parish, long been one of the worst performing school districts in the state, in the country even, of course, also plagued by factors outside of the education policy space, deep levels of poverty and inequality. So what we've seen in the charter movement is that scores, outcomes, student performance outcomes have increased. Now, have they increased as much as any of us would want to? Absolutely not. But they've made substantial increases. And in the report card that just came out, the NAEP report card yesterday, Orleans Parish was one of the top 10 districts in the state that's made some of the most significant post-COVID advances. And I want to point out, you mentioned some charters have closed. And that's the system working exactly the way it's supposed to. This is the beauty of education freedom or school choice, whether it's private school choice or public school choice like charters, is when they don't perform the way they're supposed to, they lose their charter and someone else gets another shot at it. In a traditional system, the way we've done it for 100 years, if you're failing, we just give you more money and hope that that fixes the problem. But what we know is if we can empower families to make those choices as best fit their needs and hold those accountable, and parents moving from one school to the next is one very powerful way we hold those schools accountable.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of interesting, though. I mean, I kind of tend to look at things locally at a granular level, and what I see is that charter school board policy measures, lack of implementation, lack of professionalism, you know, it just a lack of board education as to what is actually how a board operates, the functions of a board and everything else. And you go back and you look at some of these places that failed, not from a teaching perspective or right. a student accomplishment perspective, but from a governance perspective, it seems to me most of these places have failed because the governance has been horrible. They had great teachers, you know, and they had students that were performing. But we've just disrupted, you know, the lives of so many kids because we got folks that are sitting on these boards that some are well-intentioned, some not so much.
Yeah.
Some take advantage of it, of that position financially and otherwise. And we hear the horror stories all the time.
Yeah, you know, it's a fair critique. And I think, you know, I point out a couple of things. The first is the same thing happens in any system, whether we're talking about traditional public schools
exactly.
or corporate America. So there's
well,
no perfect
answer. Your point is well taken because it did happen with the public school system in the city
right.
of New Orleans, where they didn't even know how much money they had or
that's
didn't
right.
have, right? I mean, and it's like, hello, excuse me? What are we doing?
Yeah, it just blows your mind. And, you know, it's a good reminder, too, to your listeners, if you're out there and competent and can, you know, have an interest in this, volunteer to be a charter board member. They're always looking for highly competent people. There are training programs through the Louisiana Association of Public Charter Schools. So, yes, there is a need for more good focused board members. So if anybody's listening out there and is interested, get in touch. You know, there's lots of opportunities to serve.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I was, I guess, equally impressed like you were with the increase in the scores. It's always good to see that positive movement. And I think we've seen that for several years in a row now, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think we've seen policy change that has put focus back on the basics. We're actually back to teaching phonics as the core way to address the literacy crisis. We're back to fundamental numeracy. You know, we've sort of lost our way and this isn't just in Louisiana, across the country, on the curriculum front, but we're now seeing the results of those changes. We've empowered parents to make decisions. You know, it's amazing. Kids perform better when they're in a school that fits them best. And so all of these things together We're now 32nd in the country, which is not something to celebrate in and of itself, but it's a heck of a lot better than 50, and it suggests we're on an upward trajectory. We can get in the top 10, and with the changes that are being made now and the hard work of teachers and parents and students, well, we're on the right path.
Absolutely, and I know people... I'm impatient by nature, and maybe you are too, Daniel.
Yes.
You know, but this is something that we're going to reap the benefit, really. We'll see some incremental benefit here in the short term, but it's really in the mid-long term that we see that we reap the benefits of what's happening, right?
Oh, no question about it. And you know, you put all of these things together, whether it's improvement in education or investment in the state's technical and community college system or changes in the tax code and removing barriers to work. All of these things work together. And we've been talking about this for years, you and I and everybody else. It takes fundamental transformational change. We're just starting to see the first glimpses of what can happen. We have announcements of big data centers and new jobs, and things seem to really be on the upswing for Louisiana. We got to keep on that path. If we can get the education system right, if we can get the tort system right and insurance, and if we can keep that tax structure going more simple and lower, we're going to just see huge benefits across the board.
Daniel, let's focus on the Louisiana Gator Scholarship Program. There's still a lot of uncertainties with, I guess, the implementation and the financing the same. Some of that, I think, is going to be, correct me if I'm wrong, decided in this legislative session upcoming?
That's right. So the structure and the rules of the program have been implemented by BESE, the State Board of Education. The legislature will make some big decisions about what resources to put behind this, how it is subject to appropriation by the legislature every year. But soon, and the Department of Education has just put out its guidance on this. You can find out more on our website, which is aschoolthatfits.com. And all the details and the link to the Department of Ed's information are on there. They will start accepting applications here in a couple of months. And kids, families that are eligible, these are incoming kindergartners of all stripes. We've got folks who are currently enrolled in a public school who may believe that there's a different or better option for them. And any family, whether you're currently enrolled in a public, private, homeschool, whatever, who is below 250% of poverty and their annual income will be available, and those families will get priority.
You pretty much you have your finger on the pulse of what's happening up there. What are you hearing? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, we've got several things coming at each other at the same time. We've got decreasing enrollment in the traditional public schools. It's been a trend for the last 4 or 5, 6 years, even while spending on that education system has increased dramatically. We've got a broader thing, and Pelican Institute has certainly been calling for more budget restraint and focus on priorities. But I think there's a strong commitment from the governor and from legislative leaders to ensure that this Gator program has the funding it needs to succeed. I do think we will likely see demand of families perhaps outpace funding in the first couple of years as we all figure out what the options are and what families are going to want here. But I think there's a commitment from leadership in Baton Rouge to make sure this program succeeds. And success means families have the options they need that lead to the best outcomes.
Is there a minimum target number that they're talking about? I mean, you know, I know a number of members of the legislature like to kind of keep things simple, right?
And yes.
And in their messaging, is there a target number?
The target number that we've talked about and others is $100 million. So again, we're spending.
And that would equate to how many students?
That would equate to, let's see, do that math quickly. I think that equates to about 10,000 to 15,000 kids.
That's a big number.
And so
that's a big number.
It is a big number. And we're going to have lots of opportunity to see how they perform, to see what demand is. Our sense is there will be you know, especially in urban areas, though we saw some significant growth in these kinds of programs in rural areas and other states. So we're very interested to see who applies. We'll start to have some of those numbers in the next couple of months.
For the other schools, the parochial privates, if they want to participate, do they have to go through a process? And I know there's always been this hesitancy of, you know, whether they're going to have to give up any of their rights, of their decision making, and things of that nature. So where does that stand?
That's right. So they providers, whether you're a private, parochial, faith based, or other provider, will have to be approved by the Board of Education, by BESE. And there are some basic requirements laid out in the law and the regulations. But what's really valuable and good about the Gator program is it has put some baseline accountability and requirements, but it recognizes that the reason why some families may choose one school over another is because it's different. So if we make the rules of parental choice that everybody has to follow the exact same rules as the current system, then we're not really giving any choice. So this has been designed to provide accountability and transparency without disrupting the autonomy and the creativity of the existing private school infrastructure to deliver the product that they do best.
A lot of those schools, though, have been reluctant to provide empirical data about testing and things of that nature. Will they be required to do so?
That's right. And it's a good point. In previous iterations, the existing scholarship voucher program, for example, required schools to participate in the state testing. And what happens again, you know, the cadence of curriculum for a school may be different than the traditional public schools. And so the Gator program is designed, you must deliver a nationally norm reference test. So we're still comparing apples to apples for the most part, but you are not required. You can take the LEAP, the state test. That is an option to any school who wants to participate. But so long as they're reporting nationally norm reference test at the end of each year in the core subject areas, that's the requirement so that we can look at what the student outcomes are.
And the teacher standards would be the same, or because I know that some of these schools, I don't know the proper nomenclature, but I guess they have to all be certified teachers. Some I know don't have as many as others and have teacher assistants and things of that nature. Is there any consistency, or are there any regulations as it relates to that issue?
So those rules won't change from where they are now. And you know, the thing that to remember, and most folks, you know, may not have been involved in this process, but for the most part, the vast majority of private schools today are still already state approved. There's a process to go through. It's a state approval for a private school. So there are certain standards almost all of these schools are already meeting. And so that remains in place. But again, we want to make sure there's baseline accountability, transparency, and excellence with as much flexibility as possible to deliver customized education.
And I got a text here. What about teacher pay?
Yeah, this does not address teacher pay. I will say you know, just a couple of things on that. One, part of the, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about this, constitutional amendment that'll be in front of voters in March has a component that the state will pay off local school boards' pension debt as a trade-off for school boards who make those decisions about pay, giving a raise to the traditional public school and charter school teachers. So that has... that is part of the package that will be presented to voters on March 29th in the special election. And, you know, there's what we've seen in other states is when there is choice, of course, institutions of education are not just competing for students, they're competing for teachers, too. So there's some early data that suggests this has an upward impact on teacher pay across the board as well. We still have a lot more data to collect on that. A lot of these programs are new, but there's some early indications that we're seeing this is moving up teacher pay, which makes all the sense in the world. Competition does great things. All boats rise, everybody wins.
And I think y'all were following this data at one time. Correct me if I'm wrong. Where do we stand with the graduating teachers, you know, from our universities? Do we have enough in the pipeline or not?
No, we really don't. Certainly that's something to be addressed. The other thing we would say is, and I, you know, think back to maybe, you know, your time in school, my time in school, your listeners. Some of my favorite teachers came at teaching from a non-traditional pathway. I certainly had great teachers as well who came through the teaching schools. My in-laws both are public school, now retired public school teachers. So not suggesting that's bad, but some of the teachers that really inspired me were in industry and then came retired or took a career change and came into the classroom. So I think not only do we need to be focused on making sure our schools of education are recruiting and providing a pathway to bring more teachers into the classroom, but we need to look at every option on the table to bring inspiring, talented people into the classroom to get these kids ready for life.
I taught at the university level, adjunct, obviously, for a number of years. It was very rewarding. I loved it. Wish I had the time to do it today, quite frankly. I enjoyed it. And I think a lot, as you point out, I think a lot of folks looking for that second career would love to teach.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's such a rewarding thing to do. It's hard, there's just nothing better than inspiring a young person and seeing that light turn on and seeing them grow and learn. And certainly as a dad, I see it in my kids. But the chances I've had to serve just briefly in the classroom from time to time, it really is a rewarding experience.
Final thoughts, Daniel?
Final thoughts, just share a quick story that came out this morning. The monuments, some big landmarks around the state have been lit up for National School Choice Week in red and yellow, and that includes the Caesars Superdome. And the story this morning of an Eagles fan happened to drive by and thought that that red and yellow was the NFL predetermining the Chiefs as the victors. So we have School Choice Week and the Super Bowl combining with each other. It was a lot of fun.
You cannot win in today's world, ever. Oh, my God.
So we'll keep on it, keep spreading the message, and everybody enjoy both National School Choice Week and it's Catholic Schools Week this week as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Truly enjoyed the conversation with you always. Daniel Espammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Neil. You too.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line. Give us a shout. We have some time to take calls when we come back. This is Newell on WWL.
Ah, can't you see it? A glistening 100-megawatt solar field begging to be built. It's photovoltaic modules and balance of system powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean. We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No. Welcome back, folks. We've got a time to take some calls. Let's go to the talk lines. Joe, what say you, Joe?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to say that maybe the FAA and...
Joe, turn. Is that your? Is that the radio on in the background?
No, I got some people in the room.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that maybe the FAA needs to revamp some of its rules governing the flight activity so close between a military installation and a civilian airport.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, for that comment. And it very well may be the byproduct of the investigation into this. There is a confluence of a number of factors in and around Reagan. I talked a little bit about that earlier, just from my own personal experience and having listened to experts in the field, not recently as it relates to this event, but prior events over the years. You fly into Reagan and you kind of experience it depending on the threat level that's out there and things of that nature, where they kind of modify the flight path that you're going to take going in and how much time you spend over the Potomac and back and forth. And you know, there's a number of things that influence that. And one of them is definitely military traffic. There is a lot of military traffic going back and forth, providing security measures in some case to the District of Columbia and otherwise. So, as I said before, we just have to take a breath. We have to kind of wait and see where this goes and what is the cause. I'm getting text about something that President Trump has said, and I'm not going to comment on it until I see the a story. And it's, you know, you're juggling here trying to do two or three things at the same time and trying to remain current. But I hope we're not blaming it on, some legitimate criticisms of air traffic controllers and how we go about testing and things of that nature, DEI policies within the FAA and otherwise, because I evidence of that. I mean, the investigation hasn't done anything. We don't know whether or not we had people, you know, in the tower that were newbies, so to speak, or didn't have a lot of experience, or what it is, or how we assign folks in some of the most challenging airports around. Everyone relies on each other to do their job in order to create the level of safety that I talked about earlier that we've experienced in this country. And it doesn't mean you can't improve, but the fact of the matter is, as I pointed out, is, you know, air travel in this country is pretty damn safe. When you think that the last commercial aviation crash in the United States was in 2009, right? And here we are in 2025. And you think about the millions upon millions of hours of flight time and passengers and this, that, and otherwise, and more folks are actually writing about this. There are a number of publications that have posted articles on this issue, providing the same data that's out there. And, you know, so we will see. My observations earlier in my monologue was not directed at Democrats or Republicans, but everybody. I mean, you know, part of credible leadership is you don't leverage these opportunities in a nanosecond for some political purpose without having all of the details there for you. And certainly president and government leaders are going to have more of the details faster than anyone else. But I can't imagine anyone's already made an assessment as to the impact of a DEI policy on air traffic controllers within Reagan International Airport, right? I don't see that. I mean, understanding how investigations are conducted, the infancy of this, someone may have been rendering an opinion or something or whatever at this point in time, but that's all it is an opinion. It's not necessarily based on fact, right? It's not necessarily based on empirical data. So we have to be very cautious, I think, because this very much influences the psyche of the traveling public. And the psyche of the traveling public is incredibly important because air travel contributes in a huge way to the economic successes of this country. And so we should proceed with caution before anybody goes out there, stands before Mike, and starts making these pronouncements. And if, in fact, the president has done so, that's really shameful. I don't know how else to put it. So Coleman just, blaming DEI Hyde. That's not smart. It's not good. In fact, it's idiotic. You don't go down this path. You don't even have, the detail. I don't know how much information, so I shouldn't say that. But I am confident that the impact of that, and I'm sure they hadn't conducted a background on everyone that was in the tower at that point in time. And how do we know whether or not it wasn't a failure on the part of the military aircraft? We do know that the American flight was doing what it was told by the tower in its approach to the landing, right? That was not spectacular. They were doing what they were told. So I don't. It's disappointing. I don't know how else to say it. It's just simply disappointing. We're better than that. We're smarter than that. And I hope you, as the listening audience, no matter what letter you have behind your name, that you're smarter than that as well. And that's just not a wise thing to do or say, and it's shameful. And I guess I'll just leave it at that. I don't know how many more adjectives I can put to this and descriptors I can put to that. I was concerned that we were going to have folks go down that path, and they did not let me down, obviously. And I would say that is not credible leadership. Not by any stretch of the imagination. We'll be right back. We are back, folks. Give us a shout, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll go back to the talk lines. Chuck, you're up. What say you? Chuck, you there? Well, we obviously lost Chuck. I think his comment was that he, Coleman, what did he say actually?
No, Chuck's comments was he did see the press conference where Donald Trump was being critical of DEI hires for the plane crash over Reagan, and he just wanted to say that was poor leadership on the part of Donald Trump. That's what his comment was. I'm still trying to find him. I don't know if he dropped off.
I think that's going to be the consensus opinion. If somebody has a contrary opinion, I'd love to hear it. But, again, that's not credible leadership. There are good people that serve in the FAA. There are good air traffic controllers. I was in charge of the airport law enforcement detachment at Louis Armstrong International Airport for a number of years, from 1995 to 2007. Worked with those folks, worked with the airport, was a member of ALEAN, Airport Law Enforcement Action Network, I think is what it stands for. It's amazing when you separate how you forget all of the acronyms and what they actually mean. But we spent a lot of time talking about security and things of that nature and how it operates. And during the course of those activities, you got to learn a lot about that, how difficult a job it is to be an air traffic controller. There's no doubt about it. I'm not certain that I have the attention level to do what they do. When you look at those screens, it's pretty incredible, you know, and so there's a lot going on, and it's easier said than done, for certain. Are they overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated? Probably. So, I mean, it's always a challenge. But again, you know, you should wait till the investigation is complete, and not make this a political ideological statement. Right now, today, in the immediate aftermath of this event, I just don't think it's the time. And what's necessary about it, quite frankly? It's not like there's exigency here. You've already made the executive order and the pronouncements as it relates to that. You've expressed your desire. You've put your fingerprint on what it is that you are going to accomplish by this. It's going to take its course. It's going to take some time. The Supreme Court has rendered its opinion that's impacted that policy in a huge way. I don't understand the exigency. I don't understand what is the selling point that you're trying to sell, because the vast majority of people in this country, as it relate in most recent polling, is that the majority believes that it was a problem. That's a fact. So, I mean, I don't know how much more we have to push down this alleyway as it relates to this particular happenstance in the immediate aftermath of an incredibly horrific and tragic event. I mean, it's just not necessary. And, you know, so, and I don't know all the particulars. Someone says the question concerning the FAA flight controllers is how many training dollars were available over the last 4 years to keep those people current. Good question. I feel certain there's continuing education for FAA air traffic controllers. I suspect so. If not, there should be. I guess a lot of these things we will ultimately find out. The real question is how much of a priority you want to make this? What are you willing to pay? How much education is required? What are the rules, and the policies in place? And hopefully maybe, you know, this will be a byproduct of the investigation that they let the public know. Because I think it's important that the public have a level of confidence in what's being done. Let's go to Chris. Chris, you're up. What say you?
Yes, sir. Mr. Norman?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm just being blown away of your criticalness of the president, of President Trump, and why?
Well, why not?
Because you are a former law enforcement of 40 years. And you should have more respect than that. That has everything to do with it.
Respect? What are you talking about? I'm not being disrespectful to the president. I'm just
absolutely
rendering
it. You have second-guessed President Trump. You've
second-guessing is not disrespectful.
Absolutely, it is. Because
have you ever said? Are you married? Are you married?
That's. I have been married.
It's not a trick question. Have you ever second guessed your wife?
We're not talking about my wife. We're talking about you and your position of power. And it's my comment to say why do you continue to be so critical of him? And you've called for him, for us to put him in the rearview mirror.
Sure, I did.
Yeah, and people tried to do that. And to me, I hold you, people like you, accountable for trying to put him in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And the people have spoken to say, no, they want him right up front because he's a good change to say, hey, what we're doing is going to be beneficial to the whole country. And not to mention, he really
stands with the Bible. If you believe that in order to be respectful, that Newell Norman is going to become a sycophant for Donald Trump, the Republican Party, or anyone else, you are sadly mistaken.
The love of my life,
my wife and I agree on a lot of things, but we disagree on a lot of things as well. But that doesn't mean I'm disrespectful to my wife. We have a different opinion.
We have different lives.
It doesn't matter what the subject is. I'm talking about whether or not the president should, in the immediate aftermath of this horrific, tragic occurrence last evening, go before the general public and start making statements that one of the contributing factors to this is the DEI policies that were in place under the Biden administration in the FAA. We don't know that. And I suspect he doesn't know that either. And that's the only criticism that I have of this. That's not credible leadership. Credible leadership calls upon honesty, integrity, character, having the empirical data, the evidence necessary before you go talking about anything. And these generalizations, especially in the immediate aftermath of this type of an event, is not good. It's not necessary. If he wants to say it 10 days from now, okay. Once there's some completion of an investigation, he's seen an investigative report, he's got a new Department of Transportation individual in there who hasn't probably even put his pens and paper in his desk yet over there. And, you know, and I can't imagine that there's been an articulation of that and they've already reached a cause and effect as it relates to this tragic event. So I don't know, you know, what your expectations are of folks like myself that are sitting behind the mic, but this is an opinion show. Just as a reminder, this is not a news show. This is my opinion. And I try to be fair to everyone. I am a Republican. I am a conservative. But that doesn't mean that I agree with all Republicans and all conservatives. If that's what you're looking for, this is not the show for you. I hate to say it that way, but I'm not going to be a sycophant for anyone. I'll call people out when I don't think that they're doing the right thing, whether or not you're Republican, Democrat, or otherwise. And I can give you a whole list of Republicans you can talk to who'll tell you that I call them out. We'll be right back. On the text line, someone says, I love Trump, but dang, I wish someone in the White House would just tackle him every now and then when they see him walking to a podium or picking up his cell phone to text. A lot of folks are responding, former military, saying, you know, this basically the same thing. I have all the respect in the world for the POTUS, President of the United States, but sometimes we're just not saying smart things. And second-guessing the president is not being disrespectful. It's just rendering an opinion. So after the top of the hour news break, folks, we'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, about a number of things. Stay with us.